It's a week that saw the end of a long-running government shutdown, the release of new key emails and the ongoing Jeffrey Epstein saga, and more.
Ahead, we'll break down the week in politics and why it mattered.
For Friday, November 14th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Department of Homeland Security has been using Norman Rockwell paintings on social media as it frames its mission as protecting American culture.
Norman Rockwell's family doesn't like it.
We'll hear from his granddaughter.
It was so clearly framing Norman Rockwell as symbolizing the things that Homeland Security stands for.
Plus the chaotic and at times absurd soundtrack to a new video game.
It's like you would go to these record stores in Tokyo and you'd just be surrounded by like old bossa nova albums, old mambo albums.
Those stories after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. Many officials and community leaders in Charlotte, North Carolina, are opposing a pending federal immigration crackdown. They're describing it as an invasion and urging residents to protest peacefully and record agents' actions from a distance. Here's Democratic State Representative Jordan Lopez.
As a lawmaker myself, I know laws must be enforced, but the how matters. And whenever you decide that creating the perception of peace through fear tactics, through militarized agents walking down the street, that doesn't feel like a safe or a welcoming community to me. That feels like a prison.
Similar operations are underway in other Democratic-led cities. The Trump administration defends the operations as necessary for fighting crime and enforcing U.S. immigration law. Protesters clashed with police outside a federal immigration facility near Chicago. Activists claim the facility acts as a de facto detention center with inhumane conditions. Illinois State Police and Cook County Sheriffs detained 21 people by midday. The Trump administration is upending its homelessness policy with a major shift away from long-term housing. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports critics warn it could push many thousands of people back onto the streets.
The change slashes two-thirds of the funding that's long been used for permanent housing with services. Instead, it will ramp up spending on transitional housing that requires work and addiction treatment. In a statement, the Department of Housing and Urban Development says the new policies will restore accountability and promote self-sufficiency. In another change, HUD will no longer automatically renew existing programs. Advocates to end homelessness say the timing of this major overhaul is terrible. Starting in January, it will leave many places around the country with no federal funding for months. They estimate it will put 170,000 people at risk of losing their housing again. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
Israeli forces shot and killed two teenage boys in the occupied West Bank yesterday, saying they were, quote, terrorists on their way to carry out a terror attack. As NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports, it's a particularly dangerous and deadly time for Palestinians in the West Bank.
The 15-year-olds were killed in a town outside the Palestinian city of Hebron. Their deaths were confirmed by Palestinian health officials and the town mayor. The Israeli military says the two were headed to an Israeli settlement to carry out what it called a terror attack when soldiers shot them. More than 45 Palestinian children and minors have been killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank this year, according to the UN. That's as Israel has been carrying out an extended military operation in the north since January, displacing tens of thousands, the longest and largest displacement crisis in the West Bank in decades. In recent weeks, Israeli settler violence against Palestinians has also surged to an all-time high. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Stocks closed mixed today. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. An atmospheric river is dousing Southern California. National Weather Service forecasters warn it could produce rock slides and debris flows in Los Angeles, in areas of Los Angeles ravaged by wildfires earlier this year. Heavy rain is forecast for tonight and tomorrow night. A new survey shows one in eight adults in the U.S. is currently taking Ozempic, Wegovy, or similar weight loss medications. NPR's Sydney Lupkin reports that's according to the nonpartisan research organization KFF.
The number of adults taking GLP-1 drugs, which include Ozempic, Wegovy, Zepbound, and Mounjaro, is going up. It went from 6% a year and a half ago to 12% now. People are taking the drugs for chronic conditions like type 2 diabetes and heart disease, as well as for weight loss. Here's Ashley Kurtzinger, a pollster at KFF.
What was really striking to us is that there wasn't one demographic group that was kind of driving the increase. It looked like there was a pretty steady increase in use across demographic groups.
Although most people taking these drugs say they have some insurance coverage for them, more than half say the drugs are difficult to afford. KFF conducted the poll between October 27th and November 2nd. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
Marine scientists have rescued a sea otter pup in Morro Bay, California, after it was separated from its mother. The Marine Mammal Center used a recording of the lost otter's cries to lure its mother. After 2 hours, a female otter followed the boat, leading to a successful reunion. Sea otters are crucial for biodiversity, but remain threatened. I'm Ryland Barton. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, envisioning a future where learning sparks opportunity and thriving belongs to everyone. Learn more at imaginablefutures.com. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Harmony Food Co-op in Bemidji, partnering with local farms for over two decades to provide fresh and local foods, promoting sustainability through local buying. Open daily from 8 to 8, more at harmonyfoods.coop, also on Facebook. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. The government is back open after a 43-day shutdown, the longest in U.S. history. But that wasn't the only story in politics this week. House Democrats released more files related to Jeffrey Epstein, and consumers still seem concerned about high prices. It's been a busy week, so we have invited senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro, as well as White House correspondent Danielle Kurtzleben on. Nice to talk to both of you again. How's it going?
Great. Good to talk to you.
Great to be with you, Scott.
Domenico, let me start with you. Last week, we were talking about all the ways Democrats were winning. People in the party seemed excited. This week, Democrats are mad about the vote to end the shutdown. Is that as dramatic as a reversal as it seems?
Well, it's certainly a lot of whiplash for Democrats. I mean, progressives feel let down by the party again. It's yet another time when they feel steamrolled by leadership. But it's not all doom and gloom for the party coming out of the shutdown with really nothing to show for it. They elevated the issue of health care as a major issue, and that's forcing Republicans on the defensive here. And coming off Democrats' sweeping victories earlier this month in the off-year elections, affordability was the big issue there. So Democrats clearly now have these two issues to run on, especially if Republicans in Congress block the extension of health care subsidies in this promised vote that could take place next month.
And if those subsidies are blocked, there would be real consequences beyond partisan politics. Insurance premiums could go super high for people in those ACA marketplaces if they lose their subsidies. According to KFF, a nonprofit health policy think tank, premiums could go up by 114% on average. So that's more than double. That is hundreds of dollars a month for some people. And that is money they could be spending on rent or groceries or gas money.
I mean, that is notable. It's only been a few days since that vote, but it kind of seems like the White House is trying to move on from the shutdown already. Is that fair?
Yeah, and trying is the operative word there. But really, all of Washington is moving on from the shutdown, but for different reasons. Now, the White House, for its part, they seem totally fine to keep talking about the shutdown. Vice President J.D. Vance talked quite a bit about it on Fox News last night, and he was delivering the message we've been hearing from the White House for weeks, which is, the Democrats caused this, and now they've caved, so this all happened for nothing. But now you have two things happening that are nudging the White House past all of this. One is that Trump's approval, especially on the economy, has been falling and is still falling. And two, House Democrats released those Jeffrey Epstein emails that just look really bad for the president. One of them, for example, says that Trump, quote, knew about the girls. Now, this raises the perennial question about the relationship between Trump and Epstein. What exactly was the nature of their relationship, and what did Trump know?
Domenico, walk us through a little more about what were in these files and how all of this affects Trump politically.
Well, I mean, look, we've always said that Trump has a high floor and a low ceiling when it comes to his approval ratings. You know, this is unlikely to be the thing that has Trump's base abandon him. You know, that hasn't happened with any number of controversies over the decade that Trump has been on the political scene. But this does keep the pressure on Trump, something Democrats are happy to do. It's irritating for Trump. He doesn't want to talk about it. Any day Trump is having to talk about Epstein really is a bad day for him and the White House. Trump is reverting to a typical playbook here, calling it a Democratic hoax. But let's remember, he promised to release these files during the 2024 presidential campaign. And when a big part of his base believes this conspiracy that there's a cabal of high-powered people who are pedophiles in the government, then this is not something Trump wants to have to be talking about or explaining away. He wants it to go away, but the drip, drip, drip makes it hard to do that.
But it's a lot of drip, 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 and it is incredibly hard to keep track of.
Yeah, so to be super clear on all of this, what was released this week by Congress was not the Epstein files we keep talking about. The DOJ has those, and the House still has to vote on releasing those. But even if they do, the Senate might not even take it up. And if they do, it's almost certain they'll vote it down. And even if they didn't, the president could veto it. Now, given all of that, you might ask why there's so much attention on this vote. Well, part of it is that attention has just been snowballing during the long wait for the House to even vote on this, not to mention given how hard the White House is fighting it. But on a basic human level, there were very real victims of Jeffrey Epstein, and they're fighting for this, and sympathizing with them isn't partisan.
All of this is happening at a time the White House is trying to talk about affordability. We noted earlier that Trump's approval on this issue is not great. Danielle, have they made any headway with that message?
Well, that's going to remain to be seen. For now, they're talking once again about trade and tariffs. They announced on Thursday, for example, some frameworks of trade deals that they're going to work out with some Latin American countries. Now, a framework means nothing is implemented yet, but it's in the White House's interest to show they're doing things, so they're sure talking about it. Now, tariffs have raised the price on some groceries, and Americans are feeling it. So what the White House is saying they're doing is they're removing tariffs on some goods that can't be grown in the U.S., like coffee and bananas. So the White House would, by removing those tariffs, be lowering prices that they themselves helped to increase. And also, the White House will likely be trying to announce more trade moves before the Supreme Court rules on whether a bunch of their tariffs are even lawful.
Look, affordability is probably going to be the big issue for next year. And if it continues to be the main issue, that's good for Democrats since Republicans are in charge. And that's an ironic twist considering it's exactly the issue that hurt former President Biden and Democrats in the last years of his presidency and in the 2024 election.
That is NPR's Domenico Montanaro and Danielle Kurtzleben. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Scott.
Immigrants from all over the world come here to the U.S., work, and send money back to their home countries. That money makes a big difference to their families and communities back home. And as the national crackdown on immigration is heating up, those payments have not slowed down. In fact, they have surged, but only to some countries. Erica Barris from our Planet Money podcast explains why.
Larissa Vargas works at Honduras's largest bank, Banco Ficosa. She handles the more than $1 billion that come into bank accounts from other countries through channels like Western Union and MoneyGram. What has been happening this year?
Well, this year, actually, it's been quite the year. We have had a growth of 26% increase, which is not typical. So that's a lot, Erica. I mean,
at first, she was curious why people were sending way more money back to Honduras, sometimes 20 extra dollars a month, sometimes more.
I think they're sending all of, like, their life savings, too. We've seen, like, you know, remittances for $7,000, $10,000 that we know that they're not very common and that they definitely had it saved up somewhere else.
As of September, Honduras had received about as much in remittances, that's the money migrants send back to their home communities, as it did all last year, almost $10 billion. This money usually goes to fund day-to-day economic activities. In Honduras, 62% of the population lives in poverty. These remittances make up 25% of the national economy. Similar surges are happening in Guatemala, El Salvador, Haiti, which is a bit of a puzzle because you might think the opposite would be true, that immigrants would be sending less since some are afraid to go to work because of ICE
H is a Honduran construction worker in California. He asked us not to use his full name because he doesn't have legal status and he fears he'll get deported. He says he's changed his behavior. He's canceled streaming services, is buying less of everything. And he used to fly to Vegas for a fun weekend. Not anymore.
Toma el riesgo de que te encuentres con la patrulla fronteriza, con ICE.
He doesn't want to put himself at risk, find himself in the hands of an ICE agent. I asked him, were you worried about that before?
No tenía esa preocupación, pero ahora me da miedo hasta poner un pie en el aeropuerto.
No, he said he did not have that worry before. But now he says he's afraid to even set foot in an airport. And that same fear, he says, is also leading him to start planning for a future back in Honduras.
Estoy con mi esposa, hablando con ella para prepararnos.
He says he and his wife are talking about how they can send their life savings back to Honduras. He isn't yet part of the big uptick in remittances, but ideally they want to start sending $500 a month. And this right here is the solution to the mystery Larissa Vargas spotted at Banco Ficosa. She says she's seen a shift as to where the remittance money is going. Like those $7,000 or $10,000 money transfers, instead of going to family, more of that money's been going directly to savings accounts.
That's another clue that, you know, that led us on to what was happening.
These are the financial preparations for relocating an entire life. Manuel Orozco, a remittance researcher with a think tank in D.C. called the Inter-American Dialogue, was also surprised by the surge. He says the most likely reason?
Now it's the fear of deportation that is triggering people to send as much as they can in case they are deported. So it's sort of a precaution.
But remittances are only surging to some countries, but not to Mexico. Mexico is the number one destination for remittances from the U.S. And there, remittances have actually been falling in recent months. Manuel says that's because Mexican immigrants, on average, have been in the U.S. much longer than immigrants from Central America. They're less worried about deportations and less likely to be sending large chunks of their paychecks back to Mexico.
The longer you are living in the United States, the less likely you will be to continue sending money. Because there is a life cycle in the number of years sending money, and that's 30 years, and that's the top. Mexicans have been, on average, over 25 years in the United States.
Manuel says for the countries experiencing the remittance surge, there is one big problem. All that money, with new immigration to the U.S. freezing and deportations up, is very likely a temporary blip. These remittances are likely to decline in the near future. Erica Barris, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:18, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. Coming up next is your daily dose of phonology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from the state. We receive support from Bridget's Pub, located in downtown Bemidji, serving Irish and American food, offering Monday night trivia at 6:30 and open mic night on Thursday starting at 6:30. More on Facebook. Now it's time for your daily dose of phonology.
On today's date, November 14th, 2006, I get a report of a varied thrush in Britt, Minnesota. Varied thrushes are birds of the West, and if you've ever been out to Glacier National Park or just out in the western mountains, you have no doubt heard and seen these birds. They look a lot like a robin, except that where the robin would have a red breast from chin to tail feathers, the varied thrush has a red breast with a broad black bib that kind of cuts across the front of its breast. And that marks a difference between the two. Now, the varied thrush, if it shows up at your house, is unlikely to leave, probably going to stay for most of the winter if you continue to provide it with feed. But I have never heard of a varied thrush spending its entire year or life here in northern Minnesota. They somehow get blown in here off of a winter storm coming from the west, and they stay until, well, as late as April, but not much after that. I've never had a report of a varied thrush sticking around into May or June.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the University of Maryland Libraries, committed to reimagining learning, advancing the public good, and empowering research that creates a better future for everyone. More at lib.umd.edu. And from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits, at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Norman Rockwell is one of the best-known artists of the 20th century. He died in 1978, but left a legacy of images that to many are the embodiment of Americana. Paintings of Americans saluting the flag, standing up and speaking at town hall meetings, eating together, praying together. In recent months, the Department of Homeland Security has been using some of Rockwell's iconic images without permission, posting them on social media with messaging around patriotism and what some have seen as anti-immigrant sentiments. All of this at a time when the department is leading a wide-scale deportation push and often mocking online the people it is removing from the country. In response to this use, Rockwell's family members have written an op-ed in USA Today denouncing it as a shameful misrepresentation of Rockwell's work and legacy. Daisy Rockwell joins us now. She's an award-winning translator and artist and the granddaughter of Norman Rockwell. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you.
So what was your reaction to these Department of Homeland Security posts when you first saw them and became aware of them?
Well, I was very upset because it was so clearly framing Norman Rockwell as symbolizing the things that Homeland Security stands for, i.e., anti-immigrant sentiment and segregationism.
I think one thing that has really struck people are the captions. There was one DHS post. It was the painting of working on the Statue of Liberty, paired with "Protect your homeland, defend your culture."
Right.
What did that pairing say to you?
Yeah, so they looked at that painting and they saw, you know, people working on the maintenance of the Statue of Liberty, and they thought, yes, that's what we're doing. We're like, because Make America Great Again is talking about the past, is trying to revive something that occurred in the past. And I think that something, especially in the case of Homeland Security, is a segregationist past. And so that's what they saw in that picture. They're actually wrong, because if you look closely at the picture, one of the people maintaining it is a person of color. He was told not to have people of color in his paintings who weren't in subservient positions when he, by his editor at the Saturday Evening Post, but he was always sneaking people in.
You write at length in the op-ed that you and your family members believe your grandfather, Norman Rockwell, would have been devastated to see his art used this way. Why do you think that is?
Because we have really strong evidence of how inspired he became in the early civil rights movement to stand up and use his platform to send out a message in support of civil rights actions and desegregation. And so we have, for example, the Golden Rule, which is a multiracial group praying together in all different faiths. And then we have the problem we all live with, which is inspired by Ruby Bridges' solo walk to her school, desegregating her school in New Orleans.
Right, that powerful painting of a young black girl going to school with adults guarding her, their heads are out of the shot, and you see racist graffiti on the wall behind her.
By the way, today, November 14th, is the anniversary of her walk to school. So in 1964, and this is, I think, a really fascinating story, it was a few weeks before his 70th birthday that he published that painting. So it's inspiring to all of us, I think, in the family that, you know, you can keep growing and keep moving forward and keep using your platform.
DHS is still using these images.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand your family has decided not at this point to pursue legal action, to send a cease and desist letter or anything like that, but rather focus on education. Why?
Well, I mean, just if you just stand back and you see what this administration is doing, like, there's clearly not a nuanced approach to our American cultural history going on here, nor any backed for things like copyright law. So if we tried to pursue this legally, it would be long and drawn out. They obviously don't want to take it down and are doubling down in a kind of trollish way. But we think it's more important that younger people know what he stood for.
Daisy Rockwell, thank you for joining us and talking about your grandfather and the way his work is being used in this moment.
Well, thank you for having me.
And in response to NPR's request for comment, DHS sent a link to their post on X featuring Rockwell's painting, A Scout is Loyal, with a quote from the artist. Those were the days when America believed in itself. I was happy and proud to be painting it.
A huge change is coming to men's Major League Soccer. For decades, MLS has begun its season in the early spring. That season continues through the summer and into the fall, but that is out of step with how the rest of the world does it. And now the league has decided to align its schedule with other international soccer leagues. NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan joins us now. Hi, Becky.
Hey there.
Okay, so explain what this means and why is it happening?
Well, yeah, I mean, like you were alluding to, basically, you know, leagues like the English Premier League, all these other soccer leagues around the world, they run from August around through the winter and into the spring. MLS had this other schedule that was originally meant to reduce conflict for fans with other major North American sports, especially the NFL. But over time, this lack of alignment with all these other soccer leagues was causing problems for teams trying to acquire, sell players, causing problems for players. Plus, you have all these big international competitions like the FIFA World Cup, which is coming up next year. They generally take place in the summer. That's when these other leagues all have their off season, and so that was a pain for MLS.
And what will that look like when games are shifted all around?
So basically this is going to swap some of those May, June, July games for games in November, December, and February, which is obviously a concern for teams in cold weather places like Minneapolis, Montreal, Toronto, New England. Because teams make a lot of revenue from ticket sales and sales of concessions and merch at stadiums on game days. And so obviously that might be a little harder if it's cold and snowy. And so, yesterday and today, officials are acknowledging that might be tough on their fans, like CF Montreal CEO Gabriel Gervais. Here's what he said.
There will be some games where it may be colder. Absolutely. And we're going to give the best possible environment for them to be comfortable and to enjoy our product.
And so the league says it will take a midwinter break every year. They've also told cold climate teams that they will limit home games in December and February. And I guess these teams will just have to sell more soccer scarves.
Well, what about the players? What do they think about this change?
I think in general, they support the move. Here's Julian Gressel. He is a fullback with Minnesota United. He was speaking about this on his podcast Player Manager back this summer, actually, when this was all just a proposal. And at that time, he guessed that 90% of players would be in favor.
We wanted this change as a player pool. I wanted this change as a player. I think it would have broken up the season in the right ways. And it would have given more credibility throughout the world.
A lot of players spend their careers also going back and forth between the U.S. and Europe and other leagues. This just makes those kinds of transitions a lot easier.
So then is this change a done deal?
Well, actually, the players' union does have to agree to this. Switching the schedule around in such a major way will require revisions to the collective bargaining agreement. They haven't really commented on this yet, so that's still a potential obstacle, even if all these players or many of the players ultimately do support it.
That is NPR's Becky Sullivan. Thank you, Becky.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is National Native News. Programming on KAXE is supported in part by the Minnesota Humanities Center, distributing more than $6 million in cultural heritage grants.
Funding is available to individuals and organizations that will create, celebrate, and teach Minnesota's diverse arts, culture, and heritage, including Indigenous organizations, historically underrepresented communities, and recent immigrants and veterans. Details at mnhum.org/grants. And support for KAXC comes from Itasca County Habitat for Humanity, hosting their annual fundraiser, Building for Tomorrow, on Tuesday, November 18th from 4:30 to 6:30 at the Cohasset Community Center. Event includes appetizers, silent auction items, and more. Full details can be found at itascahabitat.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Housing is not just a problem in major cities in Nevada. It's also an issue in rural parts of the state, including tribal nations. Thousands of tribal members want to come back home, but there's not enough housing available at the moment. KNPR's Jimmy Romo visited two tribes to tour their newest housing developments.
On the Walker River Paiute Tribe Reservation, tribal officials and community members break ground on the highly anticipated water looping system. This water project was a decade in the making, as tribal members have been wanting to live on the reservation. And with no available housing, they can't. Gina Williams came back to the reservation a decade ago to become the housing director of the Walker River Paiute Tribe to build out the tribe. Instead, she was met with unavoidable infrastructure issues.
You're thinking, okay, you can build homes and do things and find out that that was not going to happen. There had to be a moratorium.
It wasn't until 2024 that the Walker River Paiute Tribe was approved for a $20 million grant. That funding was later taken away months after President Donald Trump took office. Walker River Paiute Tribe Chairwoman Melanie McFalls knew that although the tribe is trying to save funds, coming up with the water looping funding would be worth the investment for generations to come.
You know, it was kind of hard to give up $3 million just like that, but we had to, or else we would have lost the entire project.
40 miles north of the Walker River Paiute Tribe, Fallon Shoshone Tribe's Housing Program Development Manager, Russell Dyer-Redner, has seen how difficult getting housing can be.
It seemed like you're just basically waiting for somebody to die or something drastic to even have a chance at housing.
When Russell wanted to come back home to the reservation, he was told the same thing as many others. There's no housing available. To combat the lack of housing, the tribe is building a 22-unit housing project. These projects are adding housing to the reservation, but in small numbers with the help of federal funding. These federal funds come out of a big pot of money where all 574 federal tribes nationwide are applying for a piece of the pot. And every year, the pot keeps shrinking.
There's always going to be a shortage. But if we can meet, you know, majority of our needs, we'll do our due diligence and hopefully people will be able to come back.
And that's what tribal leaders from reservations across the state want, to bring their members back home.
That was Jimmy Romo reporting. 5 Native Americans were among the 29 people named Bush Fellows this year. The Bush Foundation provides up to $150,000 over 2 years for fellows to build on their leadership skills. In the first of 5 profiles, Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire shares what an award-winning filmmaker plans to do.
Leah Hale has been with Twin Cities PBS for 13 years and has won regional Emmys for her work, including the films Reclaiming Sacred Tobacco and The People's Protectors. But the Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate and Diné Nations artists feel she falls short in one area, technical expertise.
Learning about how to capture good quality audio, even when it comes to more of the technical side of editing, like color correcting and those types of things. That's something that I really want to learn more of because I get asked often to do mentoring to up-and-coming youth and storytellers.
Hale's grand vision is to create a worldwide network of Indigenous filmmakers and artists who will share their cultural stories authentically and accurately. Hale also hopes to use her Bush Fellowship Award to build on her Dakota language skills. Her new film, Medicine Ball, is set for release next year. It looks at how basketball emerged out of boarding schools. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From comics to games to film and TV, Indigipop X is Native American popular culture. Everyone is welcome this weekend at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Info at indigipopx.com who support this show.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com. From Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The BBC is apologizing to President Trump over a misleadingly edited documentary that aired in 2024. The documentary spliced together parts of the speech Trump made on January 6, 2021. The president has threatened to sue the British broadcaster for $1 billion unless it retracts the documentary. The BBC refuses to pay any compensation and says it did not defame the president. In light of this story, we wanted to talk about how we handle editing the president's remarks here at NPR. And to do that, we've brought in Tony Cavan, NPR's managing editor for Standards and Practices. Hi, Tony.
Hi there, Elsa.
Okay, so what is the rule here at NPR when it comes to how we approach remarks by the president of the United States, whether it's podcast or radio?
There are really two rules. There's the big rule, and that is that when you edit anything on audio, you can really manipulate it. You can change it all around. So the big rule is to make sure that we don't change the meaning of what the person we're editing says. We have to stay true to that.
Right.
With the president, there's a special rule, and it applies to the vice president and major party candidates as well, and that is that we don't do internal edits. We won't click out an or a or take out something from the middle of a sentence, even if doing that makes it easier for the audience to understand.
And we're talking about not even shortening a pause, correct?
Not on the president or the vice president. If you were interviewing me, as you're doing now, you could certainly clean it up and make me sound a little bit cleaner than I sound. But with the president, the vice president, major party candidates, you're adding something editorially if you clean up those pauses and stuff. It's important to know. And I think we show a lot of caution, even with other people, in terms of internal edits, precisely because we want things to be clear and concise. We want the listener to understand what's going on. But if you make someone sound too coherent when they're not that coherent, you may be changing the tone of what they're actually saying.
Well, I'm listening to this rationale. If we care about total accuracy, if we care about making sure that nothing is taken out of context or mischaracterized in any way, why don't we apply this rule to other important public officials beyond the president of the United States and vice president and major party candidates? Why not to foreign leaders?
Well, first of all, because the president and the vice president are so widely quoted that people may be aware of what they said and they will think we're trying to put a thumb on the scale. The second reason is because those people have a special place in our news report. If President Trump says something about a particular good or service, that can move markets. Whereas if you or I say it, it probably won't make much of a difference. So everything that a president or a vice president or even a major party candidate says has a lot more weight in the United States than something said by anyone else.
There's just a lot more at stake, is what you're saying.
Exactly. And we want to make sure that we can't be seen as trying to steer the conversation one way or the other.
And to your knowledge, how common of a rule is this among major media organizations in the U.S., this rule against internal edits of the president of the United States?
I think it's very common. I think it's what most electronic media do, although in this day and age, because everyone does audio and video, there may be places where they're newer and they haven't thought this through yet. And I will say for the record that this is one of the problems the BBC is having. They admit that that was a misleading edit and it didn't meet their standards, which is why they apologized.
Tony Cavan is NPR's managing editor for Standards and Practices. Thank you so much, Tony.
Thank you.
Picture a ball.
rolling around the Earth and picking up objects as it goes. It keeps getting bigger, grabbing people, then buildings. Growing so large, everything on Earth is stuck together. All of that happens in the Katamari series of video games. The latest game is called Once Upon a Katamari. The soundtrack, like that giant ball, is an absurd mashup of smaller parts. Music that's inspired by a mix of genres from around the world. NPR's Vincent Iacovino reports there is a message behind all of it.
Patrick St. Michel is a music journalist. He lives in Tokyo, but when he was a kid growing up in the United States, Japan meant one thing: video games.
Japan to me was where Nintendo came from, and I think for my parents it probably was just like, this is the country that's making us spend too much money.
A big part of the reason he liked these games were the soundtracks. They were rooted in the kind of musical styles he would one day write about.
You learn that a lot of that Super Mario Brothers soundtrack stuff was inspired by, like, jazz fusion artists from Japan.
And in 2004, the game Katamari Damacy really caught his attention.
I do remember booting it up, and it's just like, no, 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 no. I'm just like, what? What is this? This is the soundtrack? Then as you're playing, there's just such this diversity of sound that's going on around you as you're sort of rolling up mice and assorted food stuff to create your giant ball.
I know you love me. I wanna word you up into my life.
In the newest game in the franchise, Once Upon a Katamari, players travel through different periods of history. They'll hear electronic music inspired by the Edo period, rock music inspired by the American frontier.
The worldview of Katamari series is also, in a way, is out of the norm. It's kind of weird. It's whimsy. It's interesting.
That's producer Ryo Ishida. He says the whimsy in the music reflects the whimsy of the game. And there's a musical genre with the same whimsy that can be found all over the Katamari soundtrack, according to Patrick St. Michel. It's called Shibuya-ke. Artists like Pizzicato 5 and Cornelius created music that was experimental and worldly, a range of styles influenced by the crate-digging culture of Tokyo.
It's like you would go to these record stores in Tokyo and you'd just be surrounded by like old bossa nova albums, old mambo albums. And they used this all to create a new kind of sound that was using the past as a reference point, but also merging it with then contemporary, like, rock and dance sounds.
For an example of this, look no further than one song in Katamari Damacy called The Moon and the Prince.
The vocal slash rap, that comes courtesy of a singer named Kenji Ninuma, who, like, several decades before was a really prominent Enka singer. That to me really gets at the heart of what Shibuya-ke was really good at.
It was kind of a movement that came out of globalization, but then it too kind of globalized itself and it turned into a kind of international style.
Martin Roberts is a professor of visual and media arts at Emerson College. He argues that Shibuya-ke wasn't just a contact point for Japan and artists around the world, but that it eventually became a global genre, still inspiring musicians and video game soundtracks around the world today. This kind of global exchange of ideas, peace, it's a message buried under all the weirdness and absurdity of the Katamari series itself. At the very end of the original Katamari Damacy, the credits roll. But our character's ball keeps on rolling too. And eventually, every country on Earth is rolled up into one big unified ball. Vincent Iacovino, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You're tuned in to All Things Considered here on member-supported radio, KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. Coming up next is North Star Stories. We receive support from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing mental health care in Minnesota. November is National Adoption Awareness Month, highlighting the need for adoptive and foster care families. North Homes provides licensing and case management for those opening their heart and home. More information is available at northhomes.org. And listen to the Season Watch Pod with hosts Charlie Mitchell, Heidi Holton, John Latimer, and a rotating cast of characters. This week, a look at cranes and northern lights. Season Watch Pod, for the curious, filled with the delights of nature. New podcasts come out on Thursdays. Armory Arts and Event Center in Park Rapids hosts an open mic night Thursday, November 20th. Doors open at 6 with performances at 7. Now it's time for North Star Stories.
This is North Star Stories, voices from where we live. Today in Minnesota,
crews work to reconstruct historic Southern Minnesota Bridge. Then, a group of concerned citizens is calling for more protection for the state's natural resources and an important reminder for hunters. I'm Chantel Sings. Work is moving ahead to rebuild Mankato's historic Kern Bridge. Originally built in 1873 in South Bend Township, crews dismantled the bridge in 2020 and stored it for future restoration. Now, it will be rebuilt as a pedestrian bridge linking local parks. The Mankato City Council has approved an $8.3 million bid from Redstone Construction, bringing the total project cost to about $10.5 million. Most funding will come from federal and state resources, with construction set to begin next month. In today's main story, a group of water protectors and citizen scientists is calling for more transparency from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources about post-pipeline construction. Maya Hecht has the story.
In the years since oil began running through Enbridge's Line 3 replacement pipeline, Line 93, Minnesota water protectors and citizen scientists have taken environmental monitoring into their own hands.
Right after construction of the pipeline was completed, this group formed called Wadikawad Amikwag, which is Ojibwe for those who help beaver.
BKCAC is a federally licensed drone pilot who began working with Wadikawad Amikwag to take infrared aerial photos of the post-construction pipeline corridor.
And with thermal data, you can see upwelling water when the ground is very cold.
Line 93 crosses over 200 bodies of water, wetlands, rivers, and natural springs. The upwelling that B is looking for is a potential sign of construction damage.
We took that data and started to visit those sites on foot and or with drones to figure out if those were actual aquifer breaches.
And the group continued to visit those sites for years. In a Minneapolis conference room where B recently presented photos of upwelling water, she expressed disappointment that the DNR had not accepted her invitation to attend.
I just want them to be transparent with us. I want them to have compassion and empathy for those of us who care about this land.
I think that we're actually really transparent with this project.
Randall Dineen is a section manager with the Minnesota DNR.
We won't be able to keep, you know, like a running tally of monthly processes, but we're certainly very much, you know, keeping that website up to date.
The DNR's website does list updates on Line 93, including reports of 4 aquifer breaches caused during construction. The most recent DNR entry is dated over 2 years ago.
Things don't necessarily stay fixed.
Geologist Laura Triplett used to help Wadikawad Amikwag digest their data. With concern for wetland health, that group is currently calling for more communication from the DNR about environmental damages inflicted by Enbridge.
What Enbridge did here was careless and reckless in that they went through and punctured aquifers, changed the hydrology, and we may not really know the long-term impacts of that for quite a while.
In an email to North Star Stories, Enbridge states that the Line 3 replacement project was built under the most comprehensive regulatory framework in the state's history, with more than 60 federal, state, local, and tribal approvals. The email goes on to say that while there have been some problems, it has identified, self-reported, and corrected the problems. Maya Hecht for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories. With hundreds of thousands of hunters preparing for Minnesota's firearms deer opener this month, the Department of Natural Resources, or DNR, is reminding everyone that safe hunts are successful hunts. Officials urge hunters to review firearm safety, wear blaze orange or pink, and carefully select their hunting locations. They also advise checking all tree stand equipment. DNR officials say the goal is for every hunter, hiker, and anyone enjoying the outdoors to return home safely.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. President Trump set off a redistricting arms race this summer when he called on Texas to redraw its congressional map to favor Republicans. That battle has spread to several other states, including California and Missouri. But lawmakers in some states are pushing back. Zane Irwin of the Kansas News Service reports.
These days, the White House must be wondering, what's the matter with Kansas? Republican leaders in the Sunflower State want to follow President Trump's call to redraw congressional maps mid-decade. But even in a state that Trump carried by 16 points last year, those legislative leaders recently failed to gather enough support for a special session on redistricting.
I haven't heard a good reason yet to vote for it.
That's Mark Schreiber, a Republican from Emporia in eastern Kansas. He's one of 10 Republican state representatives who opposed a special session to redraw the map.
To me, that's not the purpose of redistricting. It's not used as a political tool to increase your majority. It's to adjust for population changes.
Kansas Republican leaders say they want to help preserve the slim GOP majority in the U.S. House to bolster Trump's agenda. That would mean targeting Sharice Davids, the only Democrat representing the state in Congress. But that effort has stalled, and lawmakers in other states are also bucking their party leaders on redistricting. Today, Indiana's state Senate president scrapped plans to consider redrawing the maps in December, saying there's not enough support in his chamber. And the Democratic state Senate president in Maryland has also dug in his heels against redistricting. Patrick Miller is a political science professor at Kent State University in Ohio. He says there's probably not one reason why some states are hitting redistricting roadblocks.
The particulars might be a little idiosyncratic to every state.
Some lawmakers in Kansas and Indiana chafed at the six-figure sums that special sessions would have cost. Other states have candidate filing deadlines that make redistricting difficult. Overall, Miller says the reasons lawmakers have for breaking with their parties might be more logistical than philosophical.
I'm sure that there are some Republican legislators out there who are opposed to Trump, who are principled about something with redistricting, but I don't see this as a pushback on Trump at all.
Kansas Representative Clark Sanders says gerrymandering is a fact of life, but he opposed redistricting in Kansas because he thought it could backfire on Republicans. The House Speaker stripped him of a leadership position for that stance. Yet Sanders maintains that carving up the 3rd District could be risky.
If we weren't careful, we might end up redistricting and making it difficult to also win in the 2nd District.
And some state lawmakers have also gotten pushback from voters. Republican Representative Adam Smith says some constituents still remember the last time the maps were redrawn in 2022.
I'm out here in northwest Kansas, and there were a lot of rural conservatives that were pretty upset with western Kansas getting drawn in with some blue areas.
Despite some setbacks, redistricting proponents in some states are still trying to convince holdouts. In Kansas, Republican leaders have vowed to put maps before lawmakers when their regular session begins in January. And legislators who opposed the special session, like Smith, say they're keeping an open mind.
If there's another map that's drawn that looks a little bit more representative for my folks, I'd probably seriously consider voting for that.
The White House will be watching Kansas and other Republican-led states to see if holdouts come over to their side, with the balance of power in Congress at stake. For NPR News, I'm Zane Irwin.
If you have ever brought food to the beach, I am sure you have had the experience of sitting on your blanket, unwrapping your sandwich, and then out of the corner of your eye, you just see a seagull standing there, staring at your lunch. Every time you turn around, the gull and its hungry beak are a little closer. So what is the best way to scare it away? Believe it or not, there are scientific studies about this. And Neelcha Bohart is the senior author of a new one out this week from the Royal Society. She's an associate professor at the University of Exeter in the UK and joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Scott.
All right, let's set things up and we will hear some of the different scenarios that you scientifically tested out. The first one is a man calmly telling a seagull to please stay away from his food.
No, stay away. That's my food. That's my pasty.
And an angry guy yelling at the seagulls.
No, stay away. That's my food. That's my pasty.
I mean, to me, option two sounds more intimidating. Is that how a seagull hears it?
Yes, that's right. It's a very polite British way of being angry at a gull, obviously. And the interesting thing here is that we played back these sounds at exactly the same volume. So normally shouting, of course, everyone thinks, of course, this is more scary. But actually, we didn't make the sound of the shouting louder. It was exactly the same volume of sound. And so this shows us that when you play back this shouting noise, the gull would fly away, meaning that they can interpret the tone of voice that we say things with.
Okay, so that answered my main question of like, yeah, of course yelling is going to be more effective, but it was the same volume, so the seagull is hearing the tone difference?
Yes, exactly. So the intonation of the way we say things is informative to them.
I mean, you've been studying this for a number of years. What is it about human-gull conflict that interests you?
There's two things that intrigue me. One is I've always been really interested in how the animal mind works. How do they use the information, especially now that humans are changing the environment all around them and everything is different from the landscape in which they evolved. And some species seem to be doing really well and others are going extinct. And so seagulls seem to be kind of the winners. But are they, or are they just making the best of a bad situation? So I'm really interested in that human-wildlife conflict. And then secondly, in the UK, they're actually in sharp decline. And in the summer, you see quite some media reports of people being extremely violent and killing these birds. And so I'm trying to find peaceful ways to mitigate this conflict.
What is the most memorable experience you have had with a seagull?
Having my food stolen. Well, I study these things and I know what to do. And then I forget because I'm just having a lovely picnic with my kids on the beach. And so, yes, it's happened twice that a gull would fly from the back and steal my kids' food. And they don't appreciate it and I don't either. So I'm learning the hard way to take heed to my own advice.
I mean, here's where I am. I love looking at gulls. I want them to thrive. I don't want them to eat my food. What is the best scientific approach to going to the beach with success, with interspecies success here?
Yes. So there is a three-step plan. One is to really keep your eye on these gulls. They will come from the back. I often compare this to, you know, people, you know, cheating in class or maybe shoplifters. When the teacher or the shopkeeper has their eye on you, you're not going to do the naughty thing you were going to do. Secondly, if you can, it helps to really block this excess path to the food. So if you can eat with your back against the wall, under a roof or umbrella or bunting, that makes it much harder for them to access and then quickly escape. And then thirdly, if they do approach, shout at them, approach them while staring at them, perhaps make yourself big, basically becoming a threat to them, and they're very unlikely to then proceed with their food-thieving plans.
Well, now I know. That's Neelcha Bohart with the University of Exeter. Thank you so much for joining me.
That was really fun. Thank you very much, Scott, for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals whose ideas, solutions, and discoveries expand people's expectations of what's possible. MacFound.org. From Odoo, maker of all-in-one management software with the goal of being simple to use for all employees. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in Northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, embracing the cooler weather with the release of several seasonal beers this November, including the Winter IPA, Holiday Ale, and Icebox Dark Lager. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Happy Dancing Turtle hosts a holiday and seasonal decor swap Saturday, November 15th from 9 to noon at their office in Pine River. Items may include lights, tablecloths, gift wrapped, and other decorations. You do not need to donate items to take items. Weather tonight, slight chance of rain, mostly cloudy, lows 31 to 39 degrees, south winds 5 to 10 miles per hour, becoming northwest, possible gusts up to 20, and tomorrow, gradually clearing, temps in the low 40s.